Medicine itself is in a real situation. We're seeing some things this morning, headlines in the UK as well. But however, we hardly understand any disease and therefore need to chronically treat symptoms, but not the causes. Consequently, drugs and other therapies help only very few patients. That is the argument of the author of The End of Medicine as We Know It, which is published now by Springer Nature. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Aachen, Professor Harold Schmidt. Professor Schmidt, good morning to you. You say, I did that, and he's not there.
No, sorry,
Professor Schmidt.
My HomePod all of a sudden started. I'm here.
Yeah, I just looked over. This is the Monday morning curse, you see.
Yeah, exactly.
I was looking at my notes and I looked up and there you were, and there you were not. So there you were gone, as my Welsh grandmother used to say. Good morning.
Yeah, sorry for that.
It's quite all right. Professor Schmidt, may I call you Harold to begin with?
Absolutely.
Right, super. Yeah. Good morning to you. So the book is called The End of Medicine as We Know It. People might think that medicine has made huge strides, that we have wonder drugs out there, that, you know, that we can treat almost anything. So your book looks a little bit differently at this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certainly since 1900, the mortality has decreased or life expectancy increased. But that is actually mainly due only to one thing, namely the prevention and the treatment of infections. So the development of hygiene, vaccination, and antibiotics. If we subtract the benefit from that, there's actually not much happening since 1900 with respect to mortality. Cardiovascular deaths have slightly decreased, cancers are increasing, immune diseases are increasing. So the net effect is plus minus zero. The biggest problem is exactly as you said, that we do not understand almost any of the chronic diseases, and therefore we can only treat symptoms forever, basically. You know, some people take their blood pressure medication for 30, 40 years, and if that would be sufficient, okay, then I would say fine. Why change the system? But actually, very few patients actually have a benefit from their medication. That may actually be a little bit surprising. And I'm also not saying that people should not take their blood pressure medication, but they should be aware of the fact that doesn't solve the problem.
I mean, what we're basically saying is that we can deal with more infection because we have become more aware of bacteria, of viruses, or whatever around. So therefore, we take more hygiene precautions. So
yes, and then vaccines were developed, and antibiotics were developed. And that was the major reason why mortality has decreased since 1900. In all the rest of medicine, it's more or less plus minus zero, surprisingly.
What about things like, I mean, if we look at cancer treatments, for example, I mean, there are cancers that were a death sentence.
Actually, most of the cancer drugs have a very minute benefit. And the overall mortality in cancer is increasing. Some people say because we get older, so that's why we experience actually our cancers. But even if you control for that, there's not so much improvement. And that's understandable. Let's say if you bring your car to the garage because, let's say, the light bulbs are constantly failing. And then the garage tells you, I know what your problem is. Your light bulbs are constantly failing. Then you would say, well, I knew that, but why? Why are they failing? And then the garage says, I don't know. Which you have to come now every 3 months and get new light bulbs. And that's basically what we're currently doing in medicine. We do not understand diseases, and we therefore sort of chronically alleviate symptoms. We give drugs that dilate blood vessels, and then surprise, surprise, the blood pressure drops. But why the blood pressure is increased, for instance, in a patient, and whether that in this specific patient really means a risk to suffer from a myocardial infarction or a stroke. That's why we treat blood pressure. We don't treat blood pressure so that everyone has the same blood pressure. We treat it so that prevent those cases of an infarct or a stroke. This, no doctor can tell the patient.
The thing is, though, perhaps that what, and also what we are doing now, I mean, because we are living longer, we are experiencing illnesses or degenerative situations. I'm thinking Alzheimer's, for example, which because life expectancy was much shorter at the beginning of, say, the 20th century, these didn't come. And obviously degenerative because, you know, the joints wear out, the bones become more brittle, etc. Are we therefore at a situation where we are managing pain rather than treating illness?
That's a good point. I mean, people are very aware to the smallest dysfunctions of their body in the moment and declare this a disease already. However, in some countries, Western countries, the life expectancy is actually decreasing. In the US since 3 years, in the UK since 1 year. So we really have a problem the way we do medicine, and the fact that we do not understand disease. We do not understand asthma. We do not understand Alzheimer. We do not understand diabetes. We really don't understand most of the diseases, surprisingly, maybe. So in diabetes, we lower glucose. Okay. But we do not understand why some patients with diabetes become blind. Get dysfunction of their nerves, get dysfunction of their kidney. We do not know this. And apart from that sort of, you could say, scientific issue that it would be better to treat the cause rather than the consequence, what we actually also not good at is in prevention. That's probably the biggest potential that we have for health, maybe not necessarily for health for medical doctors, but for health. We only spend 1% of our healthcare budgets for prevention. And, I mean, you bring your car for a service, you let other things maintain in your household, but our own body, you know, the most precious thing that we have, that we usually don't do nothing, and then all of a sudden when we're 45, symptoms arise. I don't know, the back hurts, the cholesterol is all of a sudden high, the sugar is all of a sudden high, and then we quickly do something. So we have wasted all those 30 years before not monitoring actually whether we have a slight health risk that we could easily prevent and also prevent then the later, more serious consequences.
I want to just, you just mentioned on the United States, and I just want to, it's a little bit left field, as we say, but we look at the situation in the States and the massive opioid problem they have over there with people being treated. Just give me your thoughts on that.
Now, that was definitely a contributor that made it worse. But other than that, the United States have, for instance, a prevalence of diabetes in the population close to 10%. And the prevalence in the 1960s was about 1%. So the delta between 1 to 10% is not that all of a sudden lot of genetic mutations have occurred or something. You know, that's lifestyle.
Yeah. Now, this is I'm glad you said that, because there are, you know, if you go on social media, I'm not sure if you do, Harold, but there's a famous picture of, I don't know if it's Coney Island or somewhere in the 60s or 70s, and it's a picture of the beach, and everybody is relatively in good shape. And if you took that picture in Coney Island now, or any beach, you will see that people have perhaps become a bit larger, you know, and we're talking about diabetes, we're talking about joint problems. I've just been reading the front pages from London this morning saying 34% of people in the UK do no exercise at all. And we are, you know, we have been warning people about this now for almost 20 years about this time bomb, because processed foods, no exercise, poor lifestyle choices. Yeah. And we are now at the situation where that bomb is about to go off.
Exactly. But, you know, our healthcare systems are actually input systems. The doctors are rewarded for their surgeries, the drugs they prescribe. They are not really paid for, let's say, a 1.5-hour meeting or several half an hour meetings with a patient to really make sure that the lifestyle change happens. And they are also not really educated for that. You know, they are not nutritional scientists, doctors. They are not physiotherapists. They are not personal trainers. You need, they're not psychologists. You need totally different sort of healthcare providers for prevention. It's a different job. It's a different discipline. Doctors are there for when things have gone wrong to repair things, but they're not actually educated for prevention.
But to go back to your car analogy from before, yeah, this is the difference between a garage mechanic and a car designer. So at the moment we have doctors who are, you know, my brake light, not me personally, my brake light isn't working, or I have a problem with my health, I want a quick fix, rather than a designer who goes, okay, well, if we get the airflow, if we design the shape of the car.
The design, you could say, is determined by our genes. We, except for monogenetic diseases and gene therapy, we can't do very much about our design, but we can do a lot about how we take care of our sort of car. It may have some flaws and so forth, but if we don't stress the car at certain parts too much, it will go forever. But we need to know what to care of. That's another problem that we have with prevention. In the moment, prevention is about don't do this. You have to do that. And it's an endless list. You know, eat healthy, sleep well, don't smoke, not a lot of alcohol, no stress. And it's an endless list. You know, it's very demotivating. And, you know, we all know people, you know, Churchill, no sports ever. And he became over 90. So maybe there are those lucky ones who, even without sports, will stay healthy. Or our German chancellor, he smoked menthol cigarettes, you know, constantly, packages per day, and he became 93. So there are those lucky ones which do not need to adhere to every healthcare advice.
But yeah, but that is the rare exception, isn't it? That's like the great white whale, if you like. Exception. I mean, yeah,
maybe, and we don't know those longevity genes, of course. But on the other hand, if one could show a patient, look, you really have a high risk for colon cancer, here is the genetic evidence, don't eat red meat, don't smoke, or keep it very low on red meat. All the other things we can talk later about, but first make sure you have this major risk under control. So then I think it would be much more motivating than giving a checklist of 10 preventive measures. I think that might work better, and also not talk to a medical doctor about this, but people who know how to motivate people to prevention.
What you were talking about here is, if you like, is like rather than a health service, a health team then advising motivating you.
Yeah. It's actually already developing in the US. In the US, they call it WellTech industry. So they didn't want to call it wellness or so, because that has the connotation of spas and swimming pools and saunas. No, they really want to bring a prevention in a nice manner that you like to consume as a product. It doesn't have the connotation of don't do this, you must do that. You know, that it's something that you want to do. It makes fun, and out of this build a network of prevention. Yeah.
The thing is, though, Harold, this is all very nice, and we're having this lovely cozy conversation, and it works well with people who have relatively good incomes. But if you're poor,
exactly, very good point. Very good point. Because one of the factors in sort of risk factors is actually low income. Low income. People always say it's low education. No. It's low income. Costs you 9 life years. And being male costs you another 5 years. And the bad thing is, those two health risks actually add up. So an educated woman lives 14 years longer than a non-educated or a poor income male. 14 years. So this is actually a disparity that we really need to overcome.
But also, isn't there's also an aspect here where people go, oh, well, you know, the poor eat really badly. All they eat is processed. They smoke too much. They have too much drink. You know, there is drug abuse with very, very low income in poverty, that whole trap. But it doesn't have to be like that. I have a very good friend of mine runs a community project where they bring fresh fruit and vegetables in a van to some deprived areas of Liverpool. Yeah, and there are some very deprived areas. And that has become, and they explain to people that this is what you do with the vegetables. It's easy. You can feed your family. You can have a healthy meal. It will cost less than going out for a fast food option. And people will do that. And also people will use the visit of the van as a social hub. So they interact so that they don't feel isolated, because there's a whole, we could spend the next hour talking about social interaction and its effect on health. Yeah.
But there's actually a very good book from Norina Hertz. It's called The Lonely Century. That it's extremely important for people to have social interactions. And where we're currently moving towards with social media and so-called friends, and sort of that many people live in single households, is actually, it is a mental and health risk.
Indeed. So what's, I mean,
we have to come to the positive side.
Exactly.
Of things, though.
Okay. So this isn't due. I mean, it's Monday. People will be, you know, saying, okay, that's
everyone
over.
Everyone is totally depressed now.
No. Come on. Let's look at the positives. We have a situation. How do we get out of it, Harold?
Yeah. Houston, we have a situation. So the solution is actually that we overcome the biggest mistake that we have made in medicine so far, namely that we have divided up the human body organ by organ. For every organ, we have a special. We have for the heart, the cardiologist, cardiology, for the brain, we have the neurologist and neurology and so forth. So we really believe by looking just as one organ, we can understand a disease. And if the patient has a symptom in any other organ, we deflect him to another specialist. Well, that does not work. That is the reason why we don't understand diseases. And we know this, for instance, from rare diseases where only one gene is inflicted. Those patients usually have symptoms in 2, 3, 4, 5 organs. So to define a disease by an organ makes absolutely no sense. So we have to bring all these data together, which is, of course, not manageable for a human brain, which means you need support by artificial intelligence or machine learning. You need bioinformatics. You need a really interdisciplinary so-called big data approach, which is a little bit of a buzzword. But with that, all of a sudden, we can achieve things with less people and more precise in a shorter time.
But if I'm a doctor, if I'm a surgeon, if I've done university, postgrad, 7 years of medical school.
I know,
yeah, and then surgery school. And now you're saying, sorry, but it's going to be big data machines and you need to relook at everything that you've learned.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bad news for the doctors, but it's the good news for the patient. For instance, in radiology, so where X-rays are interpreted, we're seeing that already. Artificial intelligence within 3 seconds can analyze X-rays better and more precise, 90% of all X-rays, better and more precise than a radiologist. There are 10% cases where a human being, it's better, has another look at. But that also means that the workload for the radiologist is reduced by 90%. Maybe not to scare radiologists, let's say instead of 10, we need still 2 radiologists that really spend their time on the few really complicated, interesting cases. But we will see this everywhere. There are diagnostics apps, there are therapeutic apps that really work, because what medicine is not rocket science. You learn what has been sort of acquired and knowledge, and you apply it to the patient in front of you. And that's what machine learning does. It learns everything that has ever been sort of discovered and applies it.
And also with any illness, the earlier it is detected and the less hassle, because we are by nature a lazy race, especially on a Monday.
Exactly, yeah.
And so if you think, okay, it's time for my MOT, you know, my checkup, my annual checkup, rather than booking in with the doctor and going and queuing the whole, if you can do this via an app, just to some warning signals or whatever.
Exactly.
And then of course, you catch whatever it is early, be it, you know, could be prostate cancer, could be whatever. And therefore, it takes the load off the medical service. And also, you have a better chance of living longer. And what you're also arguing is that if we do this, if we invest in this technology and we look at this approach, this, and I hate to words, the, hate to use the word holistic approach, yeah. but it, by bringing in different aspects from all sorts, then we can look at lifespan that is, that not only in terms of longevity, but also in terms of quality.
Exactly. It's not so much about living longer. It's really living healthy, or healthy aging. You know, not getting a stroke when you're 60 and just hanging in for another 20 years being disabled and so forth, but not getting a stroke and living healthy until you're 80 or 85, you know?
So why did you decide that now was the time to write this book and to put it out there and to start this discussion?
Yeah, because it makes no sense to talk only negative without the solution. It doesn't help you if you have a super diagnosis of Alzheimer, but then no treatment, you know. But now is actually, things are developing at light speed. We're doing it also in our own research, that we're beginning with genetics and big data. We work very interdisciplinary with bioinformaticians, that we start making that progress. I told you the example of radiology, which is more data analysis, but also in understanding diseases, diagnosing patients not only by the symptom, but also by the cause and treating that cause. So we're doing several clinical trials now in hypertension, in heart failure, in stroke, where we are treating actually the cause in a subset of patients. For other patients with the symptoms, we may need other treatments, or there may be some patients who have high blood pressure and don't need a treatment. So all of that is currently happening. We have just been awarded a huge European project with a fellow coordinator of 50 million euros, because the EU has really discovered this, we call it organ agnostic approach. So not divide up the human by organs, that is really the future. And I think we're making progress. We are really at the beginning of an exponential phase of discovery, and I'm pretty sure in 10 years medicine will be completely different. And the sooner you engage as a patient, or hopefully not yet patient, the better.
But what we're looking at here is a fundamental change in healthcare. Yeah, but you're going to run into, like every other industry, the motor industry, because you're in Germany, we know the motor industry, every heavy industries have all been revolutionized. Yeah,
and actually, we're used to futurologists call this the next Kondratiev wave. I don't know if you know, if you have heard of Kondratiev wave. So the invention of the steam engine, the invention of electricity, caused major socioeconomic revolutions. Some people think it's renewable energies, but actually that discovery has been long made many years ago. It's just the politicians who are too slow to implement it. But this is actually new technology coming out of a crisis, leading to a complete new system of psychosocial health. It's really, really fundamental to our society. And it's not about just taking better pills and so forth. It's valuing health as a fundamental and psychological, not only physical health, as a fundamental sort of resource or goal in life.
So we've come out of this situation, as I always call it, from the past 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay, this situation. Because if I say the word, then my phone lines go in. And people say, "No, it's all a big thing from Big Pharma. It didn't really happen."
No. Don't be afraid about that.
We've come out of the virus and the lockdown, and this is a situation. Everybody's had time to think about their health, about the systems that we use. So, Harold, in your opinion, we are now on the edge of a wave, yeah, because we have not only the knowledge about nutrition, about lifestyle, about diet, yeah, but also we now have the technology to implement these changes.
Yeah.
So therefore, this is the generation opportunity to fundamentally change and treat the way we look at health.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and The research is happening. The discoveries will be made. We have all the data from Scandinavian countries, from UK. So no one should think, "Oh, people just want my data to do this research." The research is happening. But if as a patient or not yet patient, you ever want to benefit from these discoveries that are coming now, you have to be digital. You have to digitalize yourself. We call it your digital twin. Somewhere, algorithms need to be able to interact with your data, and no one wants to suck off the data from your smartphone. No one is interested in your personal data because we have the discoveries. We don't need your personal data. But if you want to benefit from it, you need to be digital. A computer cannot interact with a PDF or with some notes from a doctor. You know, you need data. That's important. I mean, you don't have to. If you don't do it, things will go on for you like it currently does. But if you want to benefit from it, you know, be open to that.
The book is called Medicine, The End of Medicine as We Know It, and Why Your Health Has a Future. It's by Professor Harold Schmidt, who we've been talking to today. It's out now as well on Springer Nature, and it will be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. Harold, if people want to find you online, because you keep saying digital and the whole thing, where can they find you online? Is there a website? Is there a Facebook? Is there a social media? Where can we find you, Harold?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter. I'm no longer on the Facebook yeah. and so forth because of the Facebook papers. And yeah, I have a website, haraldschmidt.online, if you want to go there. But you find me also at Maastricht University. I think I'm findable.
You're findable indeed. It's been an absolutely fascinating and a great conversation for a Monday
Thank
morning.
You.
The
Thank
book
you.
Is called The End of Medicine as We Know It and Why Your Health Has a Future. It's by Professor Harold Schmidt. Harold, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.